Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because it's time. It's time for reparations.
So I'm sick of being a side Indian character.
LGBTIQ rights are black rights.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me.
I'm Gary Foley.
I'm Francesca Ramsey.
This is Amir Rahman.
And you're listening to The Race Card.
Welcome to The Race Card. I'm your host, Amina Ziyard. And joining me in studio today, we've got my co-host.
Me.
That's Ahmed Yusuf.
Oh, me too.
Arundhati.
And me as well.
And that's just free. So, before we begin, we'd like to do acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge the Kulin people as the owners of the land on which we meet, and we pay respects to their elders, past, present, and future. This land was never ceded, and the processes of colonization, occupation, incarceration, and genocide that began over two centuries ago continue to this day. We have Giselle Nguyen, writer and columnist for Daily Life in studio with us, and today we look at the Naman Haider inquest and the lure of radicalization, with a featured story on the exploitation of international students in the workforce. But first, let's welcome Giselle Nguyen.
Hi.
Sorry. That's okay. So thank you for coming to the show. And so the first part is where we'll be debuting a new segment.
It's not really new. It's kind of old. Well, it's not really old, but
it's like two episodes old.
I'm going to say three. And it's called?
It's called Up Close. Anyway, so the question, Giselle, is, would you rather eat a raw onion or drink a gallon of olive oil?
By the way, you have a period of time, and that time is around 25 seconds, and it starts now.
I would definitely eat a raw onion. If it's good enough for our former Prime Minister, it's good enough for me, so... Are we talking brown onion or red onion?
Just any onion.
Yeah, that's fine. No, a litre of olive oil would be freaking gross.
Why not brown onion? Do you have a...
No, because red onion is meant to be eaten raw, right? So that's okay.
Yeah. Oh, is it?
Yeah, like it's in salads and stuff.
Would you eat an entire onion raw?
Like
I wouldn't, but if I had to pick between that and the olive oil...
Like, I feel like olive oil would be very kind
That'd be
of,
freaking gross.
That'd
like,
be very
it would just,
hot.
You just get, like, real oily mouth... It's not very good for your health.
Yeah.
The brown onion, like the onion sounds bad as well, but it, like, would you rather is not meant to have
exactly.
good options,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So, it's true.
Yeah.
It's
also, yeah.
Like, hang on, would anyone else go the olive oil?
I mean, it might help with like your
health.
It wouldn't
ingestion.
Help with it. No, olive oil's got
How
so much
is
fat.
Gallon? Is it a gallon?
Oh, is it a gallon or a litre?
I said gallon.
What's
I said
a gallon? Oh,
no.
Gallon
that's
just
not
sounds
good for
like
you.
Knowledgeable. So
yeah, what's
I,
a gallon?
I don't know how much
a gallon is like. Isn't that like how oil is sold by the gallon?
Probably, but I'm gonna say that it's probably like half a liter, and that's a lot.
Half
versus
a lot.
Versus an onion, which is like the size of a tennis ball, if that. But so obviously, onion.
I would have given you like a humongous onion though, because I feel like a gallon of oil is a lot. So
yeah,
to
but
make
a huge onion, like it would be gross, and you have bad breath, but you probably wouldn't feel disgusting.
Okay. Well, like now we've broken the ice. I wanna kind of ask you about your writing and
sure.
and when did you start?
Start in general or start with daily life?
Start in general.
I guess that's a hard question because I've always kind of written stuff like from when I was young. I would write stories and then I went to the uni and did journalism and so I don't know. Like I've always kind of been. Writing, but in terms of doing it more professionally or whatever, I have kind of in the last 5 or 10 years done some stuff, but it's only really ramped up in maybe like the last 6 months to being a very regular thing.
What's changed?
Well, I got fired from a job and I was very sad.
What happened?
And they said that I didn't have enough experience and I was like, well, you probably could have figured that out by looking at my resume before you hired me, but okay. So I got fired from a job and it was a real bad time. And the first thing that I pitched to Daily Life was comparing being fired to like a really bad breakup, because they kind of feel exactly the same. So that's the first thing that I wrote for Daily Life. And then I did a couple of other things for them. And then someone went away. One of their regular writers went away for the summer. So they asked me to fill in every week. So I did that. And then the summer ended and then they asked me to stay on. So getting fired kind of was good in the end.
Yeah, it actually worked out pretty well for you, didn't it? And you're talking about a few things that you've written, and you talk about how you've kind of compared, I guess, being fired to a breakup. You've mm-hmm. also written something about broken friendships. Tell us about that piece and how you
okay.
wrote it.
The broken friendships one. That was actually, so usually the stuff that I write for Daily Life is stuff that I pitch, but sometimes they come up with ideas themselves and then they're like, can you write about this? So they were like, hey, we had this meeting and this is an idea we came up with and we thought you would be a good person to write it. And I was like, okay, I guess I seem like a person with no friends. Cool. So, but I do actually have experience in that from over the years. So I was like, yeah, sure. And then I sat down and I wrote it, but it was kind of weird actually, because I started that piece with an anecdote about a former friend, but I tried really hard to just make it an anecdote and not like anything mean, but like people like that were friends with us both and are still friends with her and not friends with me were pretty pissed about it, but like whatever. So
yeah, because I remember like I read it and I was looking at it, and it made a lot of sense, because usually say you have a breakup, you'd usually talk to your friends, right?
Yeah.
What happens when you don't, when you have a breakup with a friend?
Yeah, it's hard and it's weird. And I think in some ways it's kind of worse as well, because like, I don't know, especially if you've been friends with someone for a really long time and then suddenly you're not. And then sometimes you can patch it up, or sometimes it's just like done forever. So yeah, that like that piece was good for me to write, because it was something that I hadn't really thought about for a long time and kind of just like compartmentalize my feelings and being like, oh, I don't want to think about that anymore. But it's kind of good to get stuff out, and I think it's an experience that a lot of people have as well, so it's nice to write about my experience and know that I might be able to help someone else who's going through something like that.
How did it feel writing it?
It felt okay, but I would just had to make sure that I wasn't being petty, like which is because a lot of the stuff I write is about personal experiences, so I always have to be sure that I'm just being honest without making it like a really personal thing against someone. Although I guess you can't really help how people feel, and no one really likes reading stuff about themselves that is not that positive. So it's a risk, but
I guess how do you kind of manage writing about yourself in such personal terms and making it so public? How does that work?
I mean, I guess it's not really that big a deal to me. Like when I was a teenager, I had an online journal and stuff, and that was just like every detail of my life. So I don't know, it's never bothered me that much. And I wrote something about a year and a half ago for Rookie magazine, and that was about like painful sex stuff. So as soon as that was published, and if you Google my name, it's one of the first results. So I was like, well, now if you Google my name, everyone knows like these really intricate details about my vagina, so like anything else is totally not a big deal compared to that, right? So
I mean, I guess, was that Rookie article like one of the first things you'd written for like such a wide audience?
Yeah, I mean, before that, because I used to do music writing, so I'd had a bunch of stuff published, but it wasn't really about me. So I guess the Rookie thing was the first thing that was about my personal life that I had chosen to put out there. And it was kind of weird, because it was something that I hadn't really talked about. Not that many people knew about it. And then suddenly it was out there, and like my parents didn't know, and then they knew and stuff. And it was kind of weird. But like looking back, I wouldn't change it. But it is definitely an odd thing to have a thing that you like have only told a select few people, and then suddenly everyone that you've ever met and people you also haven't met know yeah. stuff about you that's pretty private. But yeah, I just don't really have any boundaries. So
Did you feel like, I guess, diving in with something like that personal straight away and sort of getting that out of the way helped you start writing other things, like for daily life, that are maybe just as personal?
Yeah, probably. But like the, yeah, I don't know. Like it's a tough balance as well, because with the daily life stuff, I don't particularly want to make my column like only about me. Like I think most things that I'm writing have a point to them, which is like, I want to talk about this stuff because other people might be going through it, or it's something that is kind of common but not that discussed, blah, blah, blah. But I think like there's definitely a point where it can be too much, and it just feels like someone is kind of just putting themselves in the center of attention for no reason other than they like attention. So that is something that I'm really aware of, and I have tried to kind of branch out a bit and write about other things too. So, other than me.
Would you say you're the kind of writer that, I don't know, overshares?
I'm such an oversharer, it's fine. Like, if you ask anyone that's friends with me, they can probably tell you some pretty gross stuff about me, because I just tell everyone everything, so.
Like, I remember reading a piece that you wrote, and I know how it feels to kind of be in the same, this strange kind of spot where you're grieving for a grandparent that you've never met.
I'd met her, but she lived in Canada, so she was always in Canada and I was always here. So I've met her, but probably like 5 times in my life. And she doesn't speak English and I speak Vietnamese, but it's not very good. And then towards the end of her life, she like had really bad dementia, so she didn't really know who anyone was. So like, I don't remember the last proper conversation that I had with her. And the last time I saw her was probably about 4 years ago, but she was in a nursing home, and like I just came and said hi and stuff, but it wasn't really anything. So yeah, it's a pretty weird feeling. And she was my last grandparent that was living as well. So yeah, it was
'cause
odd.
I saw the contrast that you made, and I kind of felt kind of that similar contrast in terms of having a grandparent die very young that I've never met and not really known, and then having kind of a great uncle that's kind of a grandparent that died but I've spent a lot of time in.
Yeah.
And then having that kind of like feeling that contrast. I should be feeling something for my mother's mother.
Yeah.
But I don't really feel that.
Yeah, I mean, my other grandma lived with us when I was growing up, and she died when I was 8 or 9, and that was weird because it was like a huge change to my everyday life, because she was always there and then suddenly she wasn't there. And with this one, like, she was never there. So, but I think just the concept of it was weird. And then seeing my dad being really sad was also, like, I think anyone seeing their parents like grieving, it's a pretty hard thing to see, especially because my dad's not a person that usually shows any kind of feelings.
So, how did it make you feel seeing that?
I mean, my parents live in Sydney, so I don't see them that often, but my mom told me, so my grandma was in a nursing home and then she just kind of stopped eating and drinking. And then my mom called me and told me that. And she said that when that happened, my dad like cried, and he never cries. So that was kind of jarring to hear. But then when she actually died, he was kind of just like, oh yeah, like it's sad, but like that's just life kind of thing. And then, so I think he kind of dealt with it before it happened. And I said, are you going to go over for the funeral? And he was like, no, because he saw her in October. So he was like, oh, I feel like I already got a chance to say goodbye. And then I was going home anyway for Lunar New Year, but it happened that my grandma had passed away like a week before. So then there was funeral stuff as well. And it was just like, it was just really sad. And he's not a person that talks about his feelings that much, so I don't really know how he feels about it. But, like, even just my mum saying that he had cried about it and stuff was pretty sad for me to hear.
Because you mentioned the article, kind of seeing your parents as children.
Yeah.
And seeing that contrast. Mm. How did that make you feel?
It's just, yeah, like I said, my dad's not a person that shows any emotion, so when he does, it's kind of, like, awkward, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, and yeah, it was just really sad. And I guess it would be different if I lived at home, because my parents are Buddhist and there's like a 49-day mourning period. So they have to go to the temple like once a week during that time. So my sister had to do that. But I was back a week ago and that was the end of the mourning period. So I was there for the last one, which is just like at the temple and there's a lot of chanting and stuff. I don't really get it, but I was there. So
yeah, like I can kind of relate in terms of not seeing, like, at least my dad, not seeing him be overly emotional, but then having these little small stints of him being emotional, and how that just, like, weighs on you.
It's pretty weird. Like, I've seen my dad cry once, and I think I was about 12, but, like...
I think that, I've seen my dad cry twice, and the first time I saw him cry was, like, when I was 11.
Yeah, I was 12, and my parents, like, had an argument or something, and he cried, and it was... Yeah, it was just super weird for me because, like, I've seen my mom cry and I've seen my sisters cry and all that stuff, but, like, never see my dad cry, so...
How does it feel to write about grief so publicly?
I don't know. Like, I think it's... It just felt like something that I should do because she passed away and I felt pretty weird about it. And then it took... Like, I waited for a few weeks before I did write about it because I wanted to kind of... process it and not write about it straight away because I knew that my feelings would possibly change. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I had people messaging me and emailing me and stuff about that piece, just saying, like, oh, I totally felt the same way about, like, some ex-relative who I didn't really know, and I don't, like, I felt weird for being so sad when I didn't really know them and stuff. So I don't know. I think, like, in with any stuff that I write about my own life, it's pretty much just sharing an experience that I know that other people will probably have, and maybe they might feel isolated or weird for having such an experience. So I think it's always helpful to read something that you can relate to and know that other people are going through the same things as you're going through, which might not always make that much sense.
On that note, you write for Daily Life, and some people say that's sort of like a women's focused magazine. In the same vein of, like, writing things that I guess, like, people can feel like, oh, well, I feel that too, you know, I can relate to that and I don't feel so, like, alone and uncomfortable reading about that. How do you feel about having a platform that is, like, predominantly women focused and being able to write about things to women?
Well, it's funny because Daily Life is definitely marketed as, like, a feminist website or whatever, but they do have male writers and they do talk about some stuff that isn't specifically women-focused, but I do really appreciate the feminist aspect of it because I have written a bit of stuff, like, specifically about feminism, and it's nice to know that I don't have to hold back on that stuff because other publications might be like, no, that's, like, too challenging for our audience or whatever, but with them they kind of encourage it. But I don't know, like, I feel like the stuff that I write about anyway, like, women would probably be more interested in it and relate to it more anyway. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't really change the way that I write because I just write things that I would want to read, I guess. So, yeah, but, I like Daily Life because there's a lot of mix of stuff and there's quite a lot of diversity and stuff. So for a mainstream publication, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I think you wrote something recently about feminist men.
Oh, my ex-boyfriend deleted me from Facebook the day after that was published, and I was like, are you not just proving my point? Like, because the whole thing was about, like, dudes who were like, oh, I'm a feminist, but then when they do something sexist and you're like, that's a bit sexist, they're just like, well, screw you. And, yeah. And then I'm like, dude, you just did exactly that. Like, thanks for proving my point, but yeah.
Because I just, specifically with that one, I feel like every single woman I've ever spoken to has had, like, exactly the same experience.
Yeah, totally. And, yeah, so that's why, like, when he was all pissed about it, I was like, well, whatever. Like, it's not only about you, and also it's not just me being this, like, bitter person with an, like, personal vendetta against you, because I spoke to heaps of people and pretty much everyone was like, let me tell you about this time that I, like, dated some guy that said he was a feminist and then this gross thing happened. So... yeah, that, like, I think that pissed a lot of people off, but I don't really care, so.
I think, like, the turnover, I mean, like, the positive effect that article had, like, totally should outweigh anything negative, because...
Yeah. I mean, someone told me that they got into an argument with some guy about that article, and he said about me, like, oh, well... This piece is probably, like, subconscious, like, unconsciously self-critical because she's just impossible to have a conversation with.
Wow.
And I just love it when men get angry. So
it was really cathartic to read. I remember reading that being like, wow, this is, like, almost every single man I've ever met. I mean, it was just a really good thing to read. And I think writing like that, that's just really, like, you know, to the point, and it's not afraid to be critical of people that we're sometimes not, like, sometimes I don't feel like I'm allowed to be critical of, like, quote-unquote allies, because I have to be grateful for what they're doing.
Nah, I reckon the allies who are, like, screaming about being allies are the worst ones.
Yeah.
And but the thing is, I feel like the piece that, like, before I edited it was a lot more scathing, but my friend was like, you should probably dial that down, and I was like, okay. But I think that, like, people, men especially, are so self-aware these days. So in the past, like, you would be able to spot a sexist from a mile away, but now, because they know all this terminology and there's a lot of, like, progressive, progressive. there's a lot of progressive men or so-called progressive men who just aren't, but it's like, if you move in the right circles and stuff, you can figure out how to be kind of convincing. Mm. So, I mean, and case in point, my ex-boyfriend used to say, like, oh, I don't call myself a feminist because we, like, know the track record of that. I'd, like, rather my actions speak for me. And I was like, well, they don't. So,
yeah.
So, people are really self-aware, and it's the same with, like, white allies or whatever. Mm. Like, there's just heaps of people who are really good at talking the talk, but they don't do anything to prove it.
Yeah.
And it's just gross. Like, it makes me feel gross.
I feel like also that's, like, kind of like a new experience, because, like you said, like, men are becoming so much more self-aware. There's not a lot of literature about that. And so the only way you can write about it is to talk about it personally.
Yeah, and I think that, like, it's not just men becoming more self-aware. It's that feminism is so much more mainstream than it used to be. Like, even if you look now, there's people like Beyoncé and whoever just kind of being very vocal about it. And when I was, like, growing up, there was no one that was really saying that in such a public way. So, like, a lot more teenage girls will call themselves feminist now than they did when I was growing up, for example. So people know that it's a thing they should be doing. So everyone's doing it, and that's good that the conversation is out there, but it means that you get a lot more weeds.
Another thing that I've noticed that you wrote about is growing up. And growing up in Australia,
mm-hmm.
often you're afraid to be, I guess, playing on those stereotypes that people have of people of colour and how that affects people. How did you deal with that?
Well, I didn't, mm-hmm. which is kind of what I wrote about. So I grew up in Sydney, in the suburbs. So my dad, when I was born, we lived in Cabramatta, which is like the Vietnamese capital of Sydney, until I was about four. And my dad still works there, so because he's a doctor and all his clients are there. But then we moved to the hills, which is like a very kind of affluent white suburb. So I was there from when I was four until I moved to Melbourne 4 years ago when I was 23. So I went, the primary school I went to, there were quite a few Asian kids, but then I moved to a all-girls school when I was in year five, and I stayed there all the way through to the end of high school, and that was a really, 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 really white environment there. So, and I think growing up, like when I was in primary school, I didn't think about it that much, but then when I started having friends who were like really privileged white people, and there's nothing wrong with them, I'm still friends with a lot of them, but it's just like a different world, and I was like, I just wished that I was like them in some ways, so I'd be like embarrassed about my parents and then be like, maybe if I was white, boys would like me and all that kind of silly stuff. And that kind of went probably like all the way through high school, and I don't really know when it changed, but at some point I was like, yeah, this kind of sucks. Like, because I feel like if you make racist jokes about yourself, it kind of makes your friends think it's fine to do the same thing. And when I look back now and remember some of the stuff that we used to joke about, I'm like, man, that is so uncool. But at the time, I think I was like, no, that's fine, because I didn't want to be like a killjoy or whatever. I'm like, I'm so fun. You can say anything you want about me.
How did that, like, you're not sure when that changed, but how did you feel at the time in that environment? It was like, I don't know how it feels to be in a very, it wasn't very white, but still very like, kind of like, well, like kind of white. Well, like, I'm going to say very white environment and being one of the few, I guess, African people in that environment, how people mistook me and kind of like said things like, oh, well, you know, you're not really black, Ahmed. You know, I'm more black than you because I can play basketball and I think I can rap.
Yeah,
so how did you feel in a similarly white environment?
I mean, it was weird because there were, so in my grade at school, there were probably 100 girls and maybe like 10 were Asian, but most of the other Asian girls were international students. So they would all kind of hang out with each other, and then people, not my friends, but people would be like something like the Asians. I'd be like, dude, what does that even mean? They'd be like, oh, no, not you, because you're a cool Asian, not an international Asian. And I was like, that's super racist, but... and it's weird how people kind of draw those divisions because it's all so arbitrary. Like if my parents hadn't been in a war and then had to flee and come here, I also would be an international Asian. And it's not, I think at the time I know that a lot of other people have similar experiences who I've spoken to, kind of take pride in being like an Australian Asian, and people are like, you're such a banana, like yellow on the outside, white on the inside. I'm like, I know, right? I'm such a banana.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, how gross is that?
A lot of people say Oreo because like black on the outside, white on the inside. I never knew anything about a banana.
Yeah, and there was a girl that I went to school with who was Indian, and she was like, I'm a crunchy because I'm like brown on the outside and blonde on the inside. And
I was like, I think it's also a coconut. I think when I was growing up, the word was coconut, right?
Yeah, there's heaps, and they're all as heinous as each other. So, yeah, but that was like definitely something to be proud of. Like, yeah, I'm totally white inside. And the thing is that these kinds of things still, people still say stuff like that. Like a few years ago, my housemate, who was my really good friend, was like, oh, yeah, you're like a white acting Asian. And I was like, what does that even mean?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, people are the worst.
Yeah, they're really, really bad.
I think that's one thing we can take away is that people are the worst.
Yeah, that's true.
And also, growing up in Australia isn't very good. thanks for coming, Giselle.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Yeah, really appreciate it. And I guess, where can listeners find you and your work?
Well, I just launched a website a few weeks ago, so it's GiselleNguyen.com. I also have a Facebook page, which is my full writing name, which is Giselle Onyen Nguyen, so that's my middle name. Or you can follow me on the various social medias at Hey School Girl. And, yeah, read my stuff.
Yeah, read her stuff. It's really good. Like, I really enjoyed your stuff. And, yeah, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Tony Abbott was really never a deeply popular figure among the electorate.
Tony Abbott faced some hostility of his own.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Dig it.
Oh, really?
And really the reason why his prime ministership has crumbled is because he lost the support of the electorate and ultimately the governing Liberal Party.
This is not an easy day for many people in this building. Leadership changes are never easy for our country.
The Prime Minister's not going to lose, he's going to win. The Prime Minister's not going to lose, he's going to win.
My pledge today is to make this change as easy as I can.
Goodbye, Tony. Bye-bye. Goodbye, Tony. Tony, time to go. Goodbye. Roll over. Knock and topic in the bed. Bye-bye, Tony.
Now we're going into the Week That Was segment, where we highlight some of the most notable or infamous stories from the past week.
And so radicalisation is a buzzword we hear, and especially so in Australia, following the 2014 Naaman Haider incident, which saw a police officer stabbed and Naaman Haider himself executed during the altercation. An inquest to the incident was heard early last week, citing police officers acted upon self-defence and fears they would otherwise be beheaded by Naaman Haider. Other reports and articles highlight Naaman expressing and practicing his Muslim identity as precursors to the altercation itself. What this incident and the discourse that follows highlight to me is the lure of and the Australian obsession with radicalization and even the academic study of radicalization theory and counterterrorism. We often pathologize and compartmentalize impressionable and misguided people like Naaman Haider, and I wanted to know why we do so. A Queering the Air 3CR interview with Arun Kundnani provides some insight. And so for our listeners who are unaware, Arun Kundnani is a former editor of the journal Race and Class. He was educated at Cambridge University, or miseducated as he says, and holds a PhD from London Metropolitan University and teaches at NYU, New York University.
This period of around 10 years ago, when a number of people wanted to try and develop this idea of radicalization, gave birth to a whole body of scholarship, and scholarship that was somewhat bogus, I would argue. So some of this was done in university departments, often funded by Department of Homeland Security in the United States, or by the Home Office in the United Kingdom. Other scholarship done by neoconservative think tanks on both sides of the Atlantic. But in all cases, what they were trying to do was to come up with a theory that would say religious ideology is the root cause of what makes someone a terrorist. And we have a model of that process that tells us here are the indicators that someone is going down this process of becoming a terrorist, driven by religious ideology, right? And millions of dollars on both sides of the Atlantic have been spent trying to find some kind of evidence to back up this model of radicalization. Of course, the evidence simply isn't there, because that's not how someone becomes a terrorist. But nevertheless, a kind of consensus emerged in spite of the lack of evidence that these models could work. And so what you end up with is a list of indicators that can be used by law enforcement agencies that say, here are the things to look for that tell you this person who's not yet a terrorist, but is going to be a terrorist in the future. And of course, it turns out that those indicators of so-called radicalization are very much to do with expressions of religious identity, rather than any real relationship to violence or terrorism.
That was interesting, because a lot of things that I've been hearing about Newman Haider was, oh my God, he's gonna cut my head off because he's got a knife, and these two officers have guns. And also kind of like this hysteria, this young boy is going to maim two armed older officers, is, I feel like it's this fancy, this idea of who Newman Haider was opposed to the reality of it.
Right. So, like, I was running with the idea that what if everything police officer said was true? What if? What if he really was a teen who was, you know, troubled, and he really was going to hurt them? You know, he brought a knife with him to arm himself or whatever. I assumed everything just as it was said. I backtracked. What would create a person like Newman Haider? That was what I was interested in. You know, why would someone end up like that? And truthfully, this is something I talk with, you know, my other colleagues. Someone doesn't become a radical because they read the Quran wrong. That is just not, you know, that just doesn't happen. You know, there is something else that happens. And in that interview, it goes on, and Arun Kundnani talks about how when we talk about this radicalization, for example, or even...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Terrorism or extremism. Extremism is something you can use to silence dissent. That's something that, you know, the British colonial times used to describe Indians who actually wanted autonomy. They wanted independence. They called them extremists. Martin Luther King was called an extremist because he wanted rights too. So when we look at the language of extremism in history, it's usually to quash dissent. So that's something that we need to be careful of. Terrorism, on the other hand, is an actual crime. It's a non-state actor. How that is defined is quite different. However, it is now seen that before you can even become a terrorist, that's where people are cracking down. It's this idea of perceptive harm, you know, perceptive danger.
But also, who is called a terrorist? And, like, for example, a few weeks ago, Barack Obama and the US government drone 150 Somalis. That's not terrorism. Right. The Brussels attack is terrorism, and that is terrorism. But why don't we call what the US government have been doing routinely, dropping drones at a number of countries where they think terrorism lies, which is a Edward Snowden, who, you know, everyone knows who Edward Snowden is, when he released that document, he, you know, it said that 90% of drone strikes don't hit the intended target. That's 90%. So you're hoping that 10% of there's a small 10% chance of someone who's actually a terrorist getting hit. And I just wonder, is innocent lives in places like Somalia, Yemen, the Middle East, and elsewhere not worth consideration, that you'd just say, oh, 10% chance it'll hit the target? Oh, that's fine. That's okay. Not taking any safeguards to protect people, apparently, because, you know, America, the free world, because they care about everyone, don't they?
Yeah, and you know, it's sometimes argued that, oh, they're sympathizers, so it's okay. You know, if they're not the attackers themselves, if they're not like the terrorists themselves, then they are sympathizers, and that's kind of like justified that way. And I guess what people don't understand is that foreign policy has something to do, and domestic policy as well, has everything to do with the way how people like Noman Haider might have felt marginalized, and because they don't have the language, they don't have the outlet to channel that, how do we say, like grief, you could say, they turn to things like, you know, violence, because that sounds very attractive. You know, they think that is the only outlet that is available to them. And so you have this, like, the system that doesn't allow for you to express, does not allow for you to dissent, does not allow for you to explore that grief and explore that complex things happening, you know, your situation living in Australia and your homeland is being bombed, and, you know, canceling of your passport and how that affects people. We don't talk about that. We just say, oh, this guy was just crazy and he was just... he read the Quran wrong.
I'm banning all rap this year at the awards. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, I love hip hop. Obviously. But tonight, it's all about soul. Okay. Hold on a second. I got another call. Wait a minute. Oh, Thugger! What's up, Young Thug? No, honestly, man, you are my favorite artist out right now. But I ain't letting anybody in with no littles and youngs and their name. Yeah. Hang on one second. I'm sorry, y'all. Yes. Who is this? Iggy Azalea. Yeah, hey. Oh, no, you can come, because what you're doing is definitely not rap. Yeah. Yeah, I got on my overalls. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to send an Uber for you right now. Yeah, come on, be outside.
One of Australia's greatest resources is its educational system. The high number of international students that travel from far and wide to study in Australia. What's happening to them when they get here?
Tonight on Four Corners, as 7-Eleven goes into damage control, we expose the wage scam at the heart of the multi-billion dollar convenience store empire.
An investigation by ABC's Four Corners and Fairfax Media found systemic corruption and exploitation to one of Australia's greatest economic commodities, international students. I wondered, is this limited to 7-Eleven? Are international students elsewhere being exploited?
Nina Hyrina.
This is Nina. She's
National President of the Council of International Students Australia.
I first asked Nina if she was exploited.
I've been exploited once for a couple of weeks in one of the, I guess, cafes.
She didn't know that she was being underpaid at the time. I wondered how that made her feel.
I basically came and then had a bit of training, you know, doing the normal productive work for a couple of days. Didn't know that I was, you're actually supposed to get paid if you're doing, you know, a productive work during those days. Right now, I guess, I felt like at the same time, I don't really, I understand that, yes, there's that part of me that, well, I was deceived and I shouldn't be treated that way. And if I knew that I was exploited, I would have probably say something to the employers, but putting myself in other people's shoes, it's really, again, I wouldn't know how to say, or I wouldn't even dare to speak up sometimes if it's that desperation.
People often ask, if you know you're being exploited, why don't you quit? Find a better job. But that's not a reality afforded to some.
Actually, they know that they're being exploited, well aware that they're being exploited, but there's nothing they can do. That's the reasons, like, no matter how many times you talk to these students, you know, you're being exploited, but they will keep saying that, well, I really need a job. I really need the money. So I know I'm being exploited. Yes, like I'm being injured. There are cases where they're being injured, but I want to talk about it. Like I really need the money. So it's a dilemma, really, to be very honest.
The few jobs that are available to international students are often those in their diasporic communities. And that's where some of the exploitation happens.
Jobs that are advertised towards them are those who are actually paying below the minimum wage. So students look to, say, just look at Gumtree or the local communities through forums, a lot of the jobs, because they're communicated through their own community, they kind of, there's this perpetuation of this culture where it's okay to advertise such job that pays below the minimum wage because, you know, it's fellow communities and they're fine with this.
The quick brown dog jumped over a lazy fox. I think that's what the quick brown dog did. That's... I mean, really, it's not even impressive. The quick brown fox would jump over like a fucking fence if you want to impress people. I'm just saying.
So what's your name?
Fox. My name's Ken.
This is Ken. He knows all too well about being underpaid in the workplace. But for him, his experience hit pretty hard.
So when I first came to Melbourne, I thought I'd be able to find a job the same way I did in Singapore, in Indonesia, in the States. But in Melbourne, it really wasn't like that. And I worked at a Chinese restaurant, which I'm not going to name here, but I worked at a Chinese restaurant which paid me $10 an hour. And that's way below the minimum wage, not to mention, like, based on my age as well, but it's way below the minimum wage. And when I brought this up, no one sided with me. And it seems really strange to me that I would come to a foreign country, work in a restaurant with people who have experienced the same experiences that I have, come from the same cultural background, and yet, instead of sympathizing, they decide to exploit you. And they decide, because they know how hard it is for you to find a job. And they know how hard it is to make a living, and that you don't have a choice. You know, you don't get to put it off and decide that I'm going to wait for something better, because you have to make that rent. You know, you have to make those bills. And they know the position they're in, and that's why they know you're vulnerable and that you will take any job that will pay you.
Why don't people speak about workplace exploitation when it comes to international students? Why don't we see the same sort of outrage that's shown to exploitation that happens in faraway countries?
What I find really, really interesting about this is that, like, I come from a, you know, being exploited point of view. Whereas if we're looking at your, you know, your local Australian residents who don't tend to experience this as often, that they don't really think twice about it. And, like, we live in an age where people worry about the fur that you wear. They worry about where their shoes are made. And they worry about, you know, whether their coffee beans are ethically sourced. But we're perfectly fine heading to a dumpling restaurant on a Friday night to celebrate with friends and have a few mojitos afterwards, whatever your lifestyle is, knowing that those people who work in those dumpling restaurants are exploited, are people just like them, possibly university students, who are working for half the wage that they're working for and doing the same amount of work, and they have no support network to help them with.
So Ken talked about having, you know, like people talking about, oh, we gotta have ethical fur, we gotta have ethical this and that, but not really caring about, I guess, how so many people are being exploited in the workplace. And we're gonna have cheap dumplings today. Oh, they only cost $8 and we get 20 pieces? Wow, that's amazing. I don't wanna think about how much the workers are being paid. And I guess how do you all feel about that kind of, I guess it's called conditional kind of morality and ethics?
I think this is an extension, perhaps, of the food industry, or the dining industry, rather. And to borrow some of the phrases from the documentary, The Search of General So, I think that's what it's called. A restaurant person, a Chinese restaurant person, said, and I quote, that there is a downward appreciation of Chinese food. And when you go to Italian restaurants or French restaurants, you will pay the price. But for Chinese and Asian restaurants, they can't really afford to do the same. Mm. Like, people will not shell their money. They will not even shell their money. They just won't, like, spare a couple more dollars. And so it's driving, you know, it's driving that industry down. At the same time, that translates to people's salaries and their wages, that it's also going to be pretty low. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, the onus is not onto any of these restaurants, but what I'm saying is it's part of a structural and bigger, I guess, a disadvantage. Definitely, for those, yeah, restaurants.
Because we all have the idea that, you know, Italian food is fancy food, and when we go out, we want to have, like, that's how much we'll pay for it. But when it comes to dumplings, we want to pay cheaply and have that, like, little quick little meal and spend the rest of our night doing something exciting and fun.
Exactly. Even though that, you know, making dumplings, for instance, actually takes skill and it takes time.
It's very labor intensive.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a reason why people eat out for dumplings and they don't make it at home, because it's labor intensive.
Who can make dumplings?
Exactly. And I guess, like, you know, taking labor for granted, but also I think it could be a couple of things. Maybe the first part is people generally don't know. I mean, that's a very, like, naive thing to think that no exploitation happens ever. But also the fact that people just don't care. Like, that's probably the second part. They don't really care.
Yeah.
Third one that I think kind of comes into this is that this idea that all international students are wealthy. No doubt you will come into this country and you do need to have some money.
Yeah.
But people don't realize that there are different ways people come to Australia. So, for example, when you see an international student here, sometimes they are funded by their community back home.
Mm-hmm.
That's something you don't know that. You know, people don't know that. Before I even got to university, like, I would see my dad and his friends pull their money for another kid in, like, the Sri Lankan community, you know, who lost a dad, or, like, the dad lost a job. And then we would all just pull our money and be like, yeah, hey, education's important. Finish it off. You know, finish your degree. And that's something that does happen behind the scenes. People just don't know that. And sometimes it's a case of the parents can pay the fees, but then they can't really pay the living expenses. And that's something that happens too. So people kind of feel like they have to, you know, get what they can get. And it's a bit unfortunate it works that way. And it's unfortunate that there are not a lot of outlets that can help those kind of students.
But what about Fair Work Australia? Why don't international students find support there? Ken thinks that's not an option.
You can report them at Fair Work, but so you lose your job. How do you make ends meet? Like, that is not a support network. That is you burning your bridges. And we are completely fine with going to Chinese restaurants and eating there all over town and not questioning how much the workers there are paid. Because there is this underlying assumption that if you have the money to come here and study, you're all right. You know, you don't have a problem making ends meet. And then we go back and worry about whether it's real fur in our coats or not.
Ken told me about his friend, who, like him, was exploited and underpaid, feeling thankful for just less than even the bare minimum, having family in turmoil, and what situations like that make people accept.
So, a while ago, I was actually working on a podcast when I interviewed a female acquaintance of mine who was not so well to do, and she came here to study in Australia. She used to study in Sydney, and her parents actually had to sell their apartment and move to a much smaller place with their grandparents in order to make ends meet so that she could pay her university fees. And when she came here, she had to earn her living for herself from scratch, which is actually not, you know, all that uncommon, really. And in order to do that, she worked at a cafe employed by someone from the same, not just China, but someone from the same province in China that she was from. And she was paid $9 an hour, and she had about 2 shifts a week for about 3 hours each. So not enough to make ends meet at all, but she felt blessed.
So between Sydney Uni and Melbourne U, I just chose Melbourne U.
This is Jo. She knew she was being exploited, but didn't have a choice. It was be underpaid or not be paid at all.
But you were being paid a lot less than the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
And was this something that you were aware of at the time?
I was. Mm-hmm. But I have no other choice. Like, you see, it's so hard to find a job. So now I got a job, no matter how much you pay, because what I have is time. So I was willing to use the time to change, like, exchange money by time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, although the payment was not, we say it was not legal or it's much lower, but yeah, just no matter, even a little I got, I feel like thankful. I would count, so say $25 for 2 hours, and this is like, let's say a portion of my rent.
Mm.
So I would count for how many weeks a week I can pay a whole month rent.
Mm.
Mm.
How many hours a week were you working?
When I just studied, it was only 2 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was like training only.
Mm.
And after, I would say after 10 to 20 weeks, I got like whole afternoon and 2 whole afternoons, and then like 1 whole day or 2 whole day, like gradually. Mm. Mm. But that's during the 2 years. During the 2 years of master, so only gradually.
The workload started to get to her. Being underpaid and overworking to compensate had her tired, sad, and feeling depressed.
Did you not feel like you were being unfairly paid?
Sure. I felt that way for numerous times. Like even, I mean, especially after a whole day, like from 9 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, like whole day just standing and working and only spent even less than half an hour sitting down, had my lunch, and after mopping the floor, after leaving the shop, when I arrived home, for several times, I was really started to cry just because of the super tightness, just because I was too tired. And
you're getting paid all of that in a day's work, you're getting paid $70 maybe?
Yeah. 90.
That is ridiculous.
So, yeah, I was complaining, and I was like, just feel too tired, and I also wanted to quit the job, but I could not, because I need the money.
Yeah.
And I remember for one time, I was like super tired, and just complained to God and cried in my prayer. And then the other day, they paid me like 17.5 per hour wage.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, God answered my prayer, but after that it mm-hmm. was still like 13
mm-hmm.
an hour.
How does that change all the time?
Well, it depends. Like sometimes they will give $5 more, sometimes $10 more. But normally average it's like 13 or 12.5.
So currently, do you know what you're entitled to?
Sorry, what do you mean?
Like, do you know, like, what sort of pay you're entitled to right now? Like, how much you should be paid?
Yeah.
And so were you on good terms with your employer at the time, like the boss of that cafe?
I was. Yeah, I was, because they are quite nice. I mean, except for not paying legally.
After time passed, the initial gratitude of finding a job passed. More and more, Gio felt reluctant to go back.
In the beginning, I was indeed thinking in this way, because I cannot find a job. So, now they offer me a job, and I was like, really thankful for. I mean, I was really thankful for them to offer me a job. But then in the second year, and especially towards the end of my master's, I was like, I don't want to come. I really don't want to come. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even, say, when my family, they came for my graduation, yeah. I was like, I want to stop for 1 or 2 weeks. And they were still messaging me or calling me to say, you're welcome to come back. But from my heart, I was not willing to come back.
Yeah. So, Amina, unlike Joe, you weren't able to get a job in, I guess, any retail or working kind of any kind of workplace. And also you are an international student and you had an interesting story about why that was. Tell us.
Yeah. So when it came to retail and hospitality, I was rejected because my English was quote unquote too good.
What does that mean?
That means. One person even told me that they didn't think international students could speak as well or have such a high IELTS score. And it was weird because, like, you can see that in my resume. And also, by virtue of me being in Australia, you have to pass some kind of English proficiency test. Everyone has to pass some kind of English proficiency test. Borders won't let you come in otherwise. So I just find that really weird. And I kind of feel like part of the reason why they didn't want to hire me was because I'm someone who can advocate for myself. If something does happen, you know, I do have the language, not just an accent, like I actually have the language, I have the words to put forward my case. Whereas there are a lot of people who might not have that. And I can only imagine how frustrating and how helpless that position can feel. When you find yourself in that situation.
Do you feel like they were looking for someone who was vulnerable?
Yeah, for sure. I think part of the lure of hiring international students is the fact that they are, not to say helpless, but they are more vulnerable.
And kind of like open to exploitation because maybe they don't have their family here like you did. Maybe they're alone. Maybe they need to pay rent and pay bills and they don't have the safety net.
When you're unaware of your rights, and you're in a foreign place, foreign land, foreign people, foreign language, and someone is threatening you or is doing something that is, exploitative to you, honestly, you will probably feel scared. You will probably, even if you do know the places to go to, you probably would be hesitant to go to them because that can, you know, have a backlash against you and you don't know how that's going to work. And you know, the repercussions are huge. So that probably means that your fees are not going to be paid, your rent's not going to be paid, and that probably means you're going to go home. And that's a huge investment. When people choose to come to Australia, people are literally shelling their money. People are putting all that they can into their kids' education. And it's, you know, it's unfortunate that the system's like that.
Gio, like Ken, knew about being underpaid. But Ken says, what exactly can you do? And what happens when exploitation is your only salvation?
It's not that she didn't know she was being exploited. She has friends here and they talk. And she hears about people who are working and earning 23 bucks an hour, maybe even, you know, 40-something bucks on weekends. Like, that's not an uncommon thing. And these are people who have the same qualifications as she is. In fact, probably less than she has in the past, who are working at major retail stores in departmental areas, which she couldn't get. And she felt blessed. And that is the same emotion that I felt when I worked at this chain, despite knowing that I was being exploited. Because there is this feeling where, like, it's almost like you're here, you don't have much of a choice, you're walking through a desert, and this is your oasis. You know, it doesn't matter how dirty the water is, it doesn't matter how little water there is. The point is, that is the best you can get. And you know, how are you supposed to feel when exploitation is the best you can get? Like, you're not about to complain about it.
Ken tells me the difference between types of international students and how they're treated.
You don't tend to have as much of an issue when it comes to, for example, someone who comes from America finding a job here. You know, they've got the option of working at an Irish bar. They've got the option of working at a coffee shop or cafe, you know, at retailing at Meijer, or which Chinese residents don't seem to have the same options.
Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of that does come from the language barrier, like I mentioned before, but like it is hard.
Really, the language barrier? Because yeah. I'm talking to you right now and your English is perfectly fine, and
no.
A lot of international students' English is, you know, perfectly fine.
And I think that is the crux of it, that there is a difference. You know, I like to say that you have Australian local residents, Australian local students, if you like to put it that way, and you have international students. But it's really not that. It's you have people who come from Anglo-centric backgrounds, for lack of a better way to put this. You know, they're different. And an American international student is not going to experience the same challenges that a Chinese international student is going to face in Australia.
Do we have some preconceived notions of particular international students? And if so, how do they form?
We have this pre-assumptions that we make that Chinese students cannot speak English. And beyond that, that's not the main... Like, I wouldn't say that is the only reason why Chinese students find it hard to get hired. I think it comes down to this assumptions that the Orientals, for lack of a more cringeworthy word, come from an entirely different culture and they have different expectations. And that's really not true, because we just want to come here, we want to study, and we want to work and get paid the right amount for the work that we do. That we shouldn't work in the same establishments and be paid different income. You know, we shouldn't be doing the same jobs and getting paid different money. It doesn't make sense. If we're in the same country, we should be paid the same amount of the same currency. And I don't think that expectation differs regardless of what country you come from. But from an employer's point of view, like what I have heard in the past, because I didn't actually talk about this before when I was talking about my friend who worked in Sydney at a cafe which exploited her, because in that same cafe, that her boss employed people from Australian backgrounds as well. They worked in the same cafe, did the same shifts, and they got paid twice her wage. And when she approached him about it, what her boss told her was that locals are more marketable. That when you have a familiar face to your store, people are more willing to come in. You know, people are more willing to come here and spend their money. They're more willing to frequently return to your establishment.
Who's to blame for the current practices and the way we see international students' worth? Ken knows exactly who.
If you're feeling uncomfortable going to somewhere to dine or going to somewhere to buy clothing because the workers there come from a different cultural heritage from you, the problem is not with the workers, the problem is with you. Like, that's the truth of it. But when you ask, can you really blame employers for selecting who they think is marketable? Yes, you can. Like, you can blame them for thinking that way. Because by choosing people that you believe are more marketable based on their appearance or based on their cultural heritage, you're just reinforcing these prejudices, especially when you're a person who comes from a minority cultural background as well.
What's going on, people? This is Akala, and right now you're listening to The Race Card. Big up.
That was a really interesting story, Ahmed.
And like, I think when you get interviews like that, you hear how personal and how troubling situations international students are facing in Australia. And I feel like people, like Ken says this really well, like people put that to the back of their mind and feel like, I don't need to think about that. I don't need to feel about that. And it's very hurtful. I imagine I'm not an international student. I can't imagine how it feels to be exploited in that way. I'm lucky that I have a parent who helps me out with my finances, that I'm able to get Centrelink, that I'm, you know, I'm a citizen of this country, so I have all these protections, but they don't. And that really, I feel like we don't talk about this enough. We see the odd article in the paper or interview on television and whatever about 7-Eleven exploiting workers, but then that buzz period goes away and it just goes back into the ether. No one talks about it. No one cares.
And I think, like, it's very telling when international students coming to Australia is actually one of the biggest economic, how do we say, factors or whatever?
Like, it gives economic, so much money goes to it.
So, yeah, we actually bring, I mean, international students bring a lot of money to, and the fact that even though we bring so much money, they don't have a lot of protection is very telling of what exactly they want from us.
It's the money, and that's all it is. It's just money. Yeah. It's troubling. But that's our show for this week. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you don't forget you can find our podcast on Acast, iTunes by searching in Race Card. You can also find us on Tumblr, which Arundhati works on. Thank you, Arundhati, for working on the Tumblr. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Facebook is facebook.com/racecardshow. We just hit 600 likes. Thank you all for everyone who's liking us and continue to like us. Help us get to 1,000. Come on. You can find us on Twitter at racecardpod. And you can also rate and review us on iTunes. You know, we need to jump on those iTunes charts. If you like our show, why don't you help us out? You can find me at AhmedYusuf10. Where else can they find you all?
Well, you can find me at Amina's Yard. No spaces, no capitals, just all together. I hope you know how to spell my name. I've spelled it out for you in the past.
You can find me at A. Arundhati. I'm going to spell my name because no one knows how to spell it. It's A-A-R-U-N-D-H-A-T-H-I.
You can't find me. Because I don't have anything.
We'll get you a Twitter one day. Soon, hopefully.
I think I need one, yeah.
It took me 6 months of convincing before I actually got one.
We'll rope you into it. We'll rope you into it. All right. That's bye from me.
Thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
See you guys.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I was going to say it's da-da-da music.